I am a criminal, and many of you out there are criminals too. Hey, AFN co-chairman Albert Kukesh is a criminal too.
Subsistence issues take center stage at AFN. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 22nd of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government designates critical habitat for the polar bear. Environmental groups hope it's not just a show.
It's hard to say that industrializing the Arctic Ocean, that allowing this offshore oil development, isn't adversely modifying the polar bear's habitat.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by...
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The 2009 Alaska Federation of Natives Annual Convention got underway in Anchorage today. This year's theme is Northern Dreams, Our Historic Journey Continues. AFN President Julie Kitka this morning said she was excited about the upcoming meeting on November 5th with President Obama and tribal leaders from across the nation. Kitka said there are always challenges in Native communities, but she says Alaska Native people have much to be thankful for.
Our land settlement, our land base, all our whole array of organizations, our for-profit economic entities, the corporations, both our village and our regional corporations, our tribal consortiums. We have so much institutional capacity, and when you take a look at other parts of the world which are struggling and have not as much as we do, you will recognize how blessed we are.
Inupiaq leader, Native land rights activist and author Willie Hensley followed. He said this year's theme is significant because of all that has changed in Native lives in such a short time span. Hensley said the stresses and strains of that rapid change have not been fully realized. He said ancestors had a harder life with few tools to make a living in a harsh environment.
But create we did. And survive we did, and expand we did, in the territories we occupied. In fact, I used to claim that as we moved across the Arctic all the way to Greenland, if we had 200 more years, we could have founded Europe.
Hensley said people understood what it meant to have no safety nets, and threats came not only from cold, ice, and famine, but also foreigners with guns, missionaries, and schools that shipped kids away from parents. He said today people are awash in material possessions that make life easier, but he worries that the massive infrastructure and institutions across Alaska may eventually be unaffordable.
That is the scary part. As I see it, when it comes to the foreseeable future, there is no urban or rural divide. In many ways, we are all in the same canoe, so to speak. Unless there is some miraculous windfall to replenish what I call, quote, the Holy Grail, the gold at the end of the rainbow, the big rock candy mountain, all rolled into one, the oil that has been the engine of life to which we have been accustomed, we Alaskans have some very hard choices to make.
Hensley's 26-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, followed her father with an inspired speech about her younger struggles, trying to reconcile her white and Native heritage and finally learning to be comfortable with who she was as both. She spoke of the importance of protecting Native lands and resources. Elizabeth Hensley is an attorney, and she said Supreme Court decisions beginning in the 1800s that extinguished Native land rights are still embedded in case law today.
But the story of the extinguishment of our rights is the Supreme Court's story. That's not our story. We have our own stories about our rights and responsibilities in relation to hunting and fishing. And our story is just as important and powerful as the one told by the Supreme Court of the United States. And we're going to have to keep telling our story and telling it and telling it and telling it until it becomes real.
She said the story of statehood is incomplete because it starts with the purchase of Alaska from Russia. And Alaska Native history must be on par with state history because the paths are now intertwined.
And it's within the best interest of both the state and Alaska Natives to tell our stories together, because from now on, our paths are intertwined. And I think the Native heritage, and this is something my dad says often, is one of the best things Alaska has going for it. It makes the state unique. So all of us Native people, we have a responsibility to step up and speak. And the state and others here who are recounting our histories have the obligation to listen to us.
Hensley said wars today for Native people don't include weapons, but rather are wars of the mind and spirit.
It's a war fought on the battlefield of administrative decisions, environmental impact statements, ANILCA 810 subsistence analyses, land management plans, resource plans. This war is as bloody and as damaging as any war fought with guns and knives.
Hensley also spoke of the pain and self-destruction of substance abuse and domestic violence and said everyone in the room had been affected by them. Governor Sean Parnell also spoke during the morning session. He agreed that domestic violence and sexual assault are tearing communities apart. Parnell talked about efforts to beef up law enforcement in Village, Alaska. Last year, the state funded 15 more Village public safety officer positions, but Parnell said there are challenges to filling those and asked for help in recruiting people. There are 71 positions, but only 58 are currently filled.
Because my goal and my dream is that we will fund another 15 positions every year for the next 10 years if we can do it, if we can fill these positions and increase law enforcement in our villages.
The growing call over subsistence protection was echoed throughout numerous AFN speeches, as well as the subject of meetings with tribal groups throughout the week. Inuit Circumpolar Conference Alaska Chair Jimmy Stotts says the ICC calls it food security, and he says subsistence rights are being whittled away and people are finding themselves on the wrong side of the law when they hunt and fish.
We are becoming criminals in our own territories. Elements of our culture are being outlawed or severely curtailed through regulation and legislation. Many of these onerous laws concern fish and game resources and our ability to harvest them to feed our families. At times, it feels like we're on the verge of getting starved out.
AFN also announced a new President's Award that will start next year for young Alaska Native women in leadership achievement. It will be called the Lou Young Award in honor of Congressman Don Young's late wife. The AFN convention continues through Saturday. The men at the center of Alaska's political corruption scheme will be sentenced next Wednesday. Today, a federal judge denied former VECO CEO Bill Allen's request for a sentencing delay. Court documents filed this week relating to his punishment shed new light on Allen's claims against Congressman Don Young. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The sentencing of Bill Allen and that of former VECO Vice President Rick Smith have been delayed in the past because they're cooperating with the FBI and federal prosecutors. The two men pled guilty in 2007 to conspiracy and bribing state and federal lawmakers to vote for legislation favorable to them and the oil industry. Allen wanted his sentencing delayed until February, but Judge John Sedgwick says his level of cooperation is already evident. The judge wrote in his decision to move forward that it's time to turn Allen's page in this lamentable chapter of Alaska's history. Prosecutors want Allen sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison and fined $750,000. They want Rick Smith sent to prison for 42 months, half a year less than Allen, and fined $7,500 to $75,000. The two former executives are hoping for far lighter sentences. Allen is asking for 6 months in prison, 6 months community service, and a fine of $150,000. Smith wants a year and a day in prison and 100 hours of community service. In court papers filed Wednesday relating to sentencing, prosecutors revealed information never before made public. They reference a United States Representative A, who appears to be Congressman Don Young, Alaska's only representative. In a confession of criminal activity, Allen talks about giving gifts to the representative and also says he gave gifts to former Senator Ted Stevens. The documents say Smith gave a $1,000 set of golf clubs to U.S. Representative A, and Allen and Smith admit to breaking federal campaign finance rules to benefit him. They say they used VCO funds to pay for annual fundraisers amounting to between $130,000 and $195,000. Congressman Young has been under federal investigation, but has said he's done nothing wrong and has not been charged. The government's case against Senator Stevens fell apart in April because of prosecutorial misconduct. In Anchorage, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, national recognition for two Anchorage prosecutors.
Ms. Thorson and Ms. White have successfully prosecuted more than 100 of the most dangerous criminals and suspected gang members in our community.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The Interior Department set aside 200,000 square miles in Alaska and offshore today to protect the threatened polar bear. The critical habitat designation is a requirement under the Endangered Species Act. Environmental groups are calling the proposal an important step for protecting polar bears, but are concerned the federal government is still allowing oil and gas drilling within the designated area. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The Interior Department's proposed critical habitat for the polar bear includes a wide swath of both the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas and a thin strip of land along Alaska's northern and western coasts. The department is calling it the largest critical habitat designation in the history of the Endangered Species Act. Rosa Meehan heads the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Marine Mammal Program in Anchorage. She says the designation allows the federal government to take a broad look at what might harm the polar bear population.
It draws a really clear line around the areas where polar bears occur, and so it makes a very straightforward statement about these are areas where there's polar bears. If you're going to be doing something that bothers polar bears, you better come talk to us about it.
But the Interior Department doesn't expect the critical habitat designation to be a significant additional burden to the oil industry. This week, the Obama administration approved Shell Oil's plan to drill two sites in the Beaufort Sea next year. Deputy Interior Secretary Tom Strickland says oil and gas activities onshore and offshore were already subject to strict review before the critical habitat designation.
It really will just reinforce what's already there, and as was demonstrated by the approval earlier this week by the Department of Shell's exploration drilling plans, it is possible to move forward with oil and gas development in a way that's responsible and manageable under these regulatory regimes.
Environmental groups question whether any oil and gas drilling can be done responsibly in polar bear habitat.
It's actually ironic. This week they've designated critical habitat for polar bear, and the same week they gave the final stamp of approval to this Beaufort Sea exploration plan for 2010.
Rebecca Noblin is a staff attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. The organization filed the original lawsuit that led to the polar bear's listing under the Endangered Species Act last year. Noblin says she was pleased to see the Interior Department designate critical habitat for the polar bear, but she says if the government is serious about saving the species, it's going to have to do more.
Since the Endangered Species Act doesn't allow federal agencies to go forward with any actions that would destroy or adversely modify critical habitat, it's hard to say that industrializing the Arctic Ocean, that allowing this offshore oil development isn't adversely modifying the polar bear's habitat, so it's hard to see how that could still go forward.
The organization is considering legal options regarding Shell's exploratory drilling plans. Along with setting aside critical habitat, the Interior Department is taking other steps to protect the bear. The administration is seeking a change in international law that would halt the commercial trade in polar bear parts. Deputy Interior Secretary Tom Strickland says the department also wants to help minimize polar bear human interactions on Alaska's North Slope.
One of the consequences of the melting of the ice is that the bears are spending more time on land and that opportunity for bear-human interaction is greater than it has been. With that in mind, we're going to beef up our efforts to work with the communities on the North Slope so that they have the tools they need to deal with what might be enhanced interaction with the bears so that at the end of the day, the bears can be deterred rather than taken.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to establish community liaisons in North Slope villages to help residents peacefully handle visits from polar bears. They also hope to hire more biologists to study Alaska's two polar bear populations. The critical habitat announcement begins a 60-day public comment period on the issue. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The state has begun a three-pronged response to what Governor Parnell calls the improper use of the Endangered Species Act to shut down resource development. He says that won't happen on his watch. In a press conference yesterday, he said the state has filed a motion in federal court against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's threatened listing of the polar bear.
The listing was outside the requirements of the Endangered Species Act. It was based on uncertain climate change predictions about the future, and it involves a species, the polar bear, with a population that is at an all-time historical high.
The rest of Parnell's plan calls for supporting in court the federal decision not to list the ribbon seal as threatened. Also, the governor plans to work with agencies and communities to support conservation measures that he says make sense for Alaska. Parnell says the state has an excellent track record of developing resources while protecting wildlife, and he says the strategy announced yesterday will help the economy and provide jobs. The six Pioneer homes around the state do not administer free prescription medicines to disabled veterans who reside there. Instead, the residents are required to purchase their medication from those state-assisted living facilities. Legislators trying to change the practice are finding a knot between the state and federal agencies. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Free or partially paid for medicine is available to veterans directly from the Veterans Administration if they've been declared more than 50% disabled. However, those medicines must be prescribed by a VA doctor and they must be obtained from a VA pharmacy. From there, they come in medicine bottles like those used by local pharmacies. If the veteran can take the medicine without nursing help, there's no problem. But staff at the Pioneer Homes can only distribute medicine that has been packaged for individual doses. Their system is safer and avoids errors. That forces residents to buy their medicine from the state instead. In a letter to Homes administrators last week, Nancy Dahlstrom and Bill Wilikowski, chairs of the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees, along with Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, offered to work with the administration to change that practice. Guerra says the problem must be solved for those who count on it.
You cannot tell a disabled veteran that even though they're entitled to free prescription medicine, you know, a sort of tiny bonus for what they've given to the country, that we're going to still make them pay for it. And that's the policy right now. You're entitled to free meds, but for those disabled veterans who can't administer it themselves, the Pioneer Home policy right now is to charge them for their prescription drugs.
Pioneer Homes Director David Cody says he's been working with the VA since last spring, trying to find a way for the free medicine to get into the state system.
When I look at should we be giving somebody a financial break, but perhaps have the liability of making a medication error, which could greatly harm a person, then, I would side on the side of safety every single time.
The legislators and Cody say there are options available, but none right now that both the VA and the Pioneer Homes can accept. If the VA would allow the state to fill the prescriptions, they'd then have to give them to the state at no charge. If the state were to repackage the medicine into individual doses, they'd have to have information they cannot get, including a manufacturer's license and expiration dates. And finally, if the state were to simply decide to provide free medicine at state expense to avoid the VA system, a VA doctor would still have to prescribe and to bypass the VA's pharmacy. And Cody says that one federal rule is the first and biggest obstacle to any change. Cody says it's not just about the Pioneer Homes. He's found that without the VA's willingness to make any change in its own system, a resolution is not likely. Guerra says he believes there are ways to deal with the problem, and he's ready to introduce legislation if that's what it takes.
Just a solution has to happen. The question is, what's the solution going to be?
Wilikowski, Dahlstrom, and Guerra are scheduled to meet with Cody and Health and Social Services officials next week to go over the options that are still available to them. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The highly successful efforts of two Anchorage city prosecutors against city gangs and violent crimes have received national recognition, KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Yesterday's award announcement by Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan began with an unusual request for a press conference.
I want to ask the TV stations for your indulgence. If you could keep the cameras this direction and not focus on two employees I'm going to recognize because of the sensitivity of their work, I would appreciate it.
The mayor then glanced toward two women quietly sitting off to his left in the back row along the wall.
I'm proud to announce that two of the municipality's prosecutors, Christine Thorson and Aaron White, who work full-time as special assistant United States attorneys at the United States Attorney's Office, were selected by the Department of Justice to receive the National 2009 Director's Award for their superior performance in combating gang crime in Alaska.
The significance of the honor is reflected in the sparse number of recipients.
Prosecutors White and Thorson are two of only three special assistant United States attorneys from the entire country to win this award this year. This is a big deal.
While White and Thorson are technically municipal attorneys and paid by the city, they're assigned to the U.S. Attorney's Office in a combined enforcement effort against gang and other violent crimes that can be pursued in federal rather than state courts. When the program was first announced, then-Mayor Mark Begich said an underlying advantage was that federal sentences with these types of crimes tend to be longer than state ones. Thorson and White work with the Anchorage Safe Streets Task Force, comprised of law enforcement officers from the Anchorage Police Department, the FBI, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The courtroom successes of the two attorneys show the effectiveness of the partnership.
During the past 2.5 years, Ms. Thorson and Ms. White have successfully prosecuted more than 100 of the most dangerous criminals and suspected gang members in our community, many of whom have previously committed other crimes and acts of violence, such as drive-by shootings and assaults. These individuals have been sentenced collectively to over 437 years in federal prison.
Kevin Feldes, chief of the criminal division, represented the U.S. Attorney's Office.
These two prosecutors have made Anchorage a safer place to live and a better place to live, and that is something everyone can appreciate here locally. And it is just wonderful that the Department of Justice nationwide has selected these two prosecutors to receive the award this year.
Another reward? According to the mayor, their work success has brought the pair a high degree of job security.
Our municipal attorney, Dennis Wheeler, is here in the back of the room, and we, in going through our budget process, we had to make some tough decisions, but this was one decision that wasn't tough when you're getting real results out there on the streets with the worst of criminals.
Thorson and White will officially receive their awards this December at a ceremony in Washington, D.C. This is Len Anderson.
A new book is out chronicling a couple's 4,000-mile trek from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands without using any motorized transport. They spoke with KUCB's Ann Hillman about their journey and their lessons learned.
From June 2007 to June 2008, author Erin McKittrick and her husband, Hig Higman, hiked, skied, and pack-rafted through urban areas and wilderness to learn about and raise awareness of environmental and conservation issues. Then, McKittrick condensed the story of the 4,000-mile trek down to 256 pages.
And I had some good editors that when they went through the book would be like, this section's redundant or unnecessary. And I would look at it and go, okay, I guess you're right, and cut it out.
What you mean the fifth spring snowstorm was redundant? I know.
The book is organized around the changing seasons and highlights different environmental issues they witnessed along the route. Higman said that for the first 2 months, as they trekked through Washington and British Columbia, it was hard to find true wilderness.
And every time you pop up over another ridge, you're looking at this sort of apocalyptic landscape of logging and flooding, and you can really see how systematic industrial use of the wilderness has led to wiping out the salmon in those areas.
McKittrick said that she could see how logging had different effects on different types and locations of forests as well. Trees grow more slowly in Alaska than in southern Canada.
And so if you were trying to think of, you know, how can we do logging sustainably, it's really not a one-size-fits-all solution. Like, doing logging sustainably where trees grow that slowly is really hard. You'd have to do it just at a very, very low level.
Their journey also taught them about the impacts of coal mining and coal as a power source, one of the major issues they currently focus on. When they reached Western Alaska, they trekked through the Pebble Mine prospect as well and spoke to employees about the operations.
You see these helicopters going around just continuously. There's three or four helicopters when we were there operating all the time, and we were talking about those helicopters, and the guy said that one of those helicopters ran like $25,000 a day, something like that. And we figure that the cost for our entire year-long trip, including like food we were eating and stuff, was somewhere around $15,000.
The couple said that in addition to learning from the wilderness experience and the different projects they encountered, they learned from the great diversity of people who took them in and spoke with them.
We ran into people in remote homesteads. We ran into, you know, we'd stayed with people in urban apartments, and we got to see little bits and pieces of so many people's lives, and that really helped us figure out what we wanted to do with their own life.
They're now settled in Seldovia, where they live in a yurt near Higman's mother and with their young son, who was conceived on the journey. McKittrick was pregnant for the last 500 miles of the trip.
We wanted to have a kid. It was, you know, maybe perhaps not the wisest decision to do it right then, but it worked out fine, and we knew that was what we wanted to do.
McKittrick said she luckily wasn't sick during that month, but she did make her husband give her a majority of the food when their rations began to run low. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Anchorage and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.